Okay. Hello, everyone. Everyone needs chizuk. Everyone needs chizuk. Everyone needs chizuk. So the proof of that is Rav Nevin Saul Shlita. As we know, sometimes he's down here and he starts reading some of these art school biographies of Gedolim. I mean, we see it, you know. So I asked Rav Chizkia Shlita once, why does your father spend time reading the art school biographies? So he said, my father says he gets chizuk from reading the stories of tzaddikim. So that's Rav Nevin Saul. So if Rav Nevin Saul reads them to get chizuk, then Kal Vachomer, all of us need chizuk. Rav Nevin Saul gets chizuk, so all of us need chizuk. For me, my go-to chizuk is hearing a famous speech from Rav Soloveitchik. It's around 9 minutes long, and I want to give the background of it and maybe develop it a little further, some ideas based on it. So Rav Soloveitchik in 1974 spoke at a Pidyon HaBen. And at the Pidyon HaBen, he developed an idea. It's written up. It's printed up in what he said at the Pidyon HaBen. And it's a very powerful idea, and it says as follows. Okay. He starts with two questions. Number one, in Parshas Vayechi, in the Chumash and in the Medrash, Yaakov Avinu is often referred to as an old man, the Zaken. Yaakov wasn't so old. So how come he's referred to as the Zaken? So that's one question. There are different answers, but that's a question. The second question the Rav asked is, you know, it's interesting, we took the name of Yaakov. We're called B'nai Yisrael Beis Yaakov. We're not called B'nai Avram, B'nai Yitzchak. So how come we took Yaakov's name as our name? So there's an obvious answer. The obvious answer is Avram had other kids who weren't Jewish, and Yitzchak had other kids who weren't Jewish. And Yaakov, all of his kids, Mita Shlema, all of his kids were the Jewish people. That's the simple answer. But the Rav thought maybe there's a deeper answer as well. Why we're called B'nai Yisrael Beis Yaakov. Well, as far, he thinks the key might be as follows. There's one way that Yaakov Avinu completely surpassed the other Avos. And that is that Yaakov Avinu had a long, complete, very deep, profound relationship with his grandchildren, Menashe and Ephraim. When Yaakov comes to Mitzrayim, he's an old man, and for those 17 years, the Medrash describes, he became the primary Rebbe of Menashe and Ephraim. Now it's true, Chazal say, you work out the years, that Avraham learned with Yaakov and Esav when they were young, and he was nifter around their bar mitzvah time, a little later. But there's no question that Yaakov's Baal Mesora was Yitzchak. That was his main Rebbe, and then Shem Ve'Aver. It wasn't Avram Avinu. But Yaakov Avinu became the Baal Mesora of Menashe and Ephraim. Their primary, to such an extent, that Yaakov does something startling in Parshas Vayechi. Totally startling. Yaakov makes Menashe and Ephraim into Shevatim. Amazing. There's his grandkids. Menashe Ephraim, Keruvein B'Shimon Yuli. There's a halachic statement in the Gemara that B'nei Banim Hareim Kibanim. Grandkids are like kids. And they're different Makaros. So some Makaros in Chazal quote this pasuk. This is the pasuk which teaches B'nei Banim Hareim Kibanim. Because that's what Yaakov did. He made his grandkids like his kids. It's a startling sentence. That Yaakov became their primary Rebbe. In other words, Yaakov Avinu experienced the Masorah fully, not only for one generation, but for two. Yaakov Avinu experienced the Masorah fully. He became the main Rebbe of his grandchildren. The other Avos, only one generation. But Yaakov was for two. Oh. So the Rav said this would answer the two questions. Number one, this is why the Torah and the Medrash emphasize Yaakov was a Zaken. Because even as an old man, he was connecting. When you're the old grandfather, you know, and your kids are using the fancy computer things, and you still use this, you know, and he's out of touch. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, there's a generation gap a lot of times. Sometimes the grandfather can't relate and connect fully with the grandson. So Yaakov breathed the generation gap. He became the main Rebbe. So the Medrash wants to emphasize the old man, the Zaken. He was the one who was teaching his became the main Rebbe of his grand, that's why it says Zaken. And number two, the Rav said, and this was the main point of his whole was, that's why we have the name of Yaakov as our name. Because the essence of Yahadus is Mesorah. The Mesorah. Yaakov Avinu, more than the other Avos, represents the idea of Mesorah. More than the other Avos, because he experienced the Mesorah fully, not only for one generation, but for two. Oh. And therefore, we took his name, B'nai Yisrael, we are the children of the Mesorah. That's our job. All of us have a job in life. We receive the Torah, the Mesorah, from our parents, from our Rebbeim, our teachers. We absorb it, hold on to it, try to conquer it, guard it, master it, and then pass it on to the next generation. That is really the essence of Yahadus. And this is why we have this name, because we took the name of Yaakov as our name. And the Rav uses a phrase there. I like this phrase a lot. He calls it the march of centuries. That Yahadus is not about, it's about the march of centuries. We're on a march from Avram, from Mitzrayim to Mashiach. That's a nice title, whatever. From Mitzrayim to Mashiach, the march of centuries. So that's the phrase. And the Rav used that phrase. He used it a lot, by the way. I've heard in other tapes. But that's the phrase he used in this particular Dvar Torah. Oh. And then the Rav said that once they developed the idea of Mesorah, once you're in the Mesorah, and it's your father, and then it's your grandfather, he says, well, you know, and your grandfather's quoting his Rebbeim, and then there's no end. And it's all one big, the symposium of generations. It's all one big, the generations unite, and a person's learning Torah now, and he's mamish connecting with the great Rav of 200 years ago, and they're alive for us right now. And even though they're physically dead, but we're studying their ideas, and we're learning their Torah, and it's as if they're here with, and it's as if they're here with us right now. Well, so that idea of bridging the generation gap, teaching Torah to your grandkids, and feeling like you're part of this living Mesorah that goes all the way back. So the Rav said he experienced it when he gave shiur. He gave this shiur in 1974. He was 71 years old. He was an old man. And he was teaching the boys in shiur, you know, the 19, 20-year-old boys. They could have been his grandchildren. So the Rav then described what he felt like giving shiur as an old man. And he said what he described about Yaakov and his grandkids, he experienced himself giving shiur as an old man in YU. Oh. So we're going to play that tape now. The Rav's talking. The whole tape is 45 minutes. It's about a pigeon, a ben, the whole thing. This is 9 minutes from that tape. Now, the Rav spoke his original language. He used Yiddish. Then he switched to English. He spoke a very, very high-level, fancy English. And he had a very heavy European accent. So it's a little hard to follow. So this 9 minutes, I think, has several thousand downloads. I put it up there. Whatever. Okay. That's my credit. Because I found the best quality and I put it up. So now we're going to play the tape now. It's this side of the page. There's a transcription. Transcription word for word. Even the mistakes are in here. So if you read along while they're playing the tape, you can follow very clearly.
As a matter of fact, I want to tell you, and please don't misinterpret my words. I'm not trying to brag or to boast. I mean, very far from it. But whatever I said now is not just an idea. To need an experience. Let me say that the secret of this paradise of combining, uniting, merging many generations into one community, where the discrepancy of each disappeared, where years play no role, centuries have no significance, where generations, I mean, can, so to say, commune with each other. I do experience every time I enter the classroom at Yeshiva. I've been a teacher for the last how many years? Oh, you make me very old. Whenever I enter the classroom, which is crowded with boys who could be, as far as age is concerned, my grandchildren. I enter the classroom as an old man, I am old, with a wrinkled face and eyes reflecting fatigue and the sadness of old age. You have to be old in order to experience that sadness. It's a very strange sadness. It's the melancholy of things, of memory, of remembering things. Things who have disappeared, don't exist. When I enter a classroom, I sit down, and opposite me, rows of boys, young boys, with beaming eyes, beaming faces, clear eyes, radiating the joy of being young. Well, always when I enter, you know, I enter in a very pessimistic mood. I always enter the class in despair. And I ask myself, I mean, every time I enter the classroom, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students? Between a rabbi in his Indian summer and boys enjoying the spring of their lives? I start here. I don't know what the conclusion will be. Whenever I study here, the door opens, another old man walks in and sits down. He is older than I am. Oh, the Talmud will tell you the rabbi, he is older than the rabbi. He is the grandfather of the rabbi. His name is Reb Chaim Brisker, and without whom, no fear can be doing that nowadays. Then the door opens quietly again, and another old man comes in. He's older than Reb Chaim. He lives in the 17th century. What's his name? Shach Saitoin, is the famous Shach, who must be present when dinomomenes are being discussed, when we study about Mitzia, about the coming. But, and then more visitors show up. Some of the visitors lived in the 11th century, some in the 12th century, some in the 13th century, some lived in antiquity. Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, Rabbi Netam, the Ravid, the Rashbo, more and more tapir coming. Of course, what do? I introduce them to my pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam says something, the Ravid disagrees. Sometimes it's very nasty. Okay. Very sharp. How strong is he uses against the rival? The boy jumps up to defend the Rambam against the rival. And the boy is fresh, you know, even boys are, young boys are fresh. So the language he uses is improper, he uses improper language. So I correct him. And another boy jumps up with a new idea. The Rashbo smiles gently. I try to analyze what the young boy meant. Another boy intervenes. We call upon the Rabbi Netam to express his opinion. And suddenly, a symposium of generations comes into existence. Generations! Young boys, 22, 23, 24 years of age. Our boys are just 18 years old, I'm in my class. One generation, then my generation, then the generation of Reb Chaim Brisker, then the generation of the Shah, then the generation of of the Rashbam, the Rambam, the generation of the Rambam, generation of Rashi, the generation of the Rabbeinu Tam. And then, I mean, there's no end. What's about Rav Haibel? What's about Rav Akiva? Rav Elazar, Rav Yechon, the Zaka? All generations somehow. We all speak one language. We all chat, we all laugh, we all enjoy the company, and we all pursue one goal. We all are committed to a common vision, and we all operate in the same categories. There is massive collegiality, friendship, comradeship between old and young, between antiquity, middle ages, and modern times. The rockets, this unity of generations, this march of centuries, this conversation of generations, this dialogue between antiquity and present, will finally bring the redemption of the Jew. Let me tell you that at the conclusion of 3 and sometimes 4 hours, I mean, I have here a good witness. I emerge young, emulated, younger than my kids. They are tired, exhausted, some of them young. I feel happy. I have defeated age. I have defeated oldness. I emerged young, less fatigued, less exhausted than my young pupils. We belong to the same Masora community where generations meet, where hands, no matter how wrinkled and parchment dry in one hand is, and how soft and warm the other hand is, unite. And in a community where the great dialogue continues, when I was looking at the baby, was redeemed this evening. I don't know whether he'll be my voice, whether I wish to have him, but someone will sit and teach the baby. And the baby is already a member of the community, of the great Masora community. And I feel as if it's possible to establish communication with this baby.
Okay, so now, this was a pigeon of Ben. 1974, there was a baby there. The rest of this year is about Pidyon HaBen, very beautiful. Okay, so the baby's father was in his 20s. He was in the Rav Shir in 74. The baby's grandfather was there at the Pidyon HaBen. He was in the Rav Shir in the late 40s. And then the Rav mentioned, so that's 3 generations, the baby, the father, and the grandfather. Then the Rav mentioned at the speech that the grandfather's grandfather in the 1940s sent the Rav a letter, keep an eye on my grandson for me. So the Rav had a letter from the baby's great great grandfather, that's number 5, keep an eye on the grandfather, and the Rav has, he said it was in a nostalgic mood, and he spoke about the Masorah. So this is Yadus. This is Yadus that we're living now based on and together with the whole Masorah from the previous generations. They're alive. They come alive in a sheep. Rav Shechter Shlita, when he spoke about the Rav Shir, he said, this is what it felt like. He said, when the Rav gave Shir, you felt Rabbeinu Tam was in the room. You felt Rav and Abayu were in the room and they're arguing. That's what he said. It felt like. The Rav, for a lot of his career, came to New York for 2 days a week, Tuesday and Wednesday. Then later he came for 3 days, for Tuesday and Wednesday. And he gave a lot of shir Tuesday, a lot of shir Tuesday night. So the Rav Shechter said, the joke in YU was, on Monday and Thursday we have Kriyas HaTorah, and on Tuesday and Wednesday we have Kabbalas HaTorah. That's how they viewed shir back in the day. So this is the march of centuries. And you make decisions in life, and based on how it's going to affect not just you and your family, but centuries and centuries. That's what we're on a march to make it to, but we're going to get there. Hashem promised the Torah is not going to be forgotten. We're going to make it to Mashiach, but we have to make sure that we stay on that path. So why are we talking about this now? A, I think it's always good to hear this. This is what a very important idea. And to understand the march of centuries, you know, when you go through life and you're making decisions in life, think about whether the Rashba would smile gently at that decision. That's what the Rashba smiles gently. He's sitting in chair, the Rashba smiles gently. So last week, something had happened recently, the giving smicha to women. So that's a thing that happened. It happened already a couple years ago, and it happened again recently. So giving smicha to women has nothing to do with the March of Centuries. If you had to look at the dictionary, the March of Centuries, and the antonym, you'd say the women rabbis. And it's a problem, and it's nothing to do, whatever it is, it's not Orthodox. It's nothing to do with Orthodoxy. Women rabbis is not Orthodox, it's been other things, and it's a problem. And now, how are you supposed to address this? So I'll tell you, my opinion is that you need the big people to address. These are the big issues. You have to have big people. So you know, there's a phrase we talk about, the system works. So how does this, here's how the system works. The system works, this is for the last 10 years, things like this have been going on. So Rav Shechter Shlita, Gadol, he writes tshuvas. He's written a few tshuvas on the topics relating to radical feminism. And they're out there. And then the main person who's been presenting the Torah approach to this in the YU world is Rav Meir Twersky Shlita. He's written three articles. We're going to read some of them now. Very good art, very strong Divrei Torah on these topics. He presents his grandfather's approach. He's authoritative. And he writes there in the footnotes that, you know, he's doing this at the request and in consultation with Rav Shechter Shlita. And he writes, and these are the articles that everyone's quoting. But the week to week, month to month, like things are happening, like what's happening out there. So there's another, a friend of mine, Rav Avraham Gordimer Shlita, wonderful Talmud Chacham. So he writes articles. So if you're interested in these topics, he's the one to go to. So, you know, I send out my Divrei Torah on the list. So this past week, I sent out links to these. I sent links to Rav Shechter and links to Rav Twersky and links to Rav Gordimer to see what's going on. And the system works. And people know what the Torah's approach is, what Rav Salvechik's approach is. So already years ago, Rabbi Twersky wrote about this, because this isn't the first time that there are two so far. So now, in the last couple of years, they began giving smicha to women. It's a new thing. So let's read it from Rabbi Twersky. I think you have to go to the big people. In light of all of the above, we are privileged to understand and appreciate the authoritative position of all Gedolim. Of course, its authoritativeness does not depend upon our oft-times inadequate understanding. It is overwhelmingly clear that a woman serving in the very public religious leadership role of rabbi directly violates and contradicts the entire Masorah regarding the Jewish women and her feminine Selam Elokim. Again, it's a much longer article. You should read the article from Rav Twersky. Then here he quotes more from the Rav. The women's issues, which in certain circles fuel much of the opposition to halacha today, had already begun percolating in the Rav Salvechik's lifetime. The Rav sensitively and unapologetically addressed it to the surface issues as well as the underlying etiology. So let me explain the word apologetics. It's a good word to know. It's very important. This is a very important yisod. Apologetics means somebody asks you a question and you're on the defensive and you have to defend your position. So you start explaining and defending your position with this, even though I hear what you're saying, but I'm going to defend myself. So the Torah is perfect. The Torah doesn't need any defense. What Rav Salvechik did, and what Twersky does, is explain the Torah's position. So unapologetics means I'm not defending myself against something out there. I don't need to. I'm with Hashem. I'm explaining the Torah's position. And in all the Rav's writings, that's what he did. This paragraph 3 is a famous quote from another tape of the Rav. We must not yield. I mean, emotionally, it is very important. We must not feel inferior. Experience or develop an inferiority complex, and because of that complex, yield to the charm. Usually it's a transient and passing charm of modern political and ideological svaras. I said, not to compromise, certainly not to compromise, but not to yield emotionally. not to feel inferior, not to experience an inferiority complex. The thought should never occur that it's important to cooperate just a little bit with the modern gender, with the secular, modern philosophy. In my opinion, Yadis does not have to apologize either to the modern woman or to the modern representatives of religious subjectivism. There's no need for apology. We should have pride in our Mesorah, in our heritage. And of course, certainly it goes without saying, one must try not to compromise with these cultural trends. One must not try not to gear the halachic norm to the transient way of an erotic society, which is what our society is. Well, and that's the Rav talking and just explaining the Torah's position. And then Rav Twersky, in his articles, he's very strong. So the idea that we should adjust the Mesorah to fit modern, different type of thinking, it's an old issue. The conservatives did it already. The argument that contemporary moral harash should march in step with the times and make concessions to prevent assimilation is hauntingly familiar. Now, this paragraph is from the conservatives' tshuva. You know, they used to write tshuvas. They're responsum about the driving the show on Shabbos. We similarly state, this is conservative now. We similarly state in our program for the revitalization of the Sabbath that the traditional interdiction of riding on the Sabbath for the purpose of attending synagogue service may, in the discretion of the local rabbi, be modified. We must learn to adjust our strategy to the realities of our time and place in keeping with the realistic genius of the great builders of our faith. Thus, our sage has cautioned us to fast and revolt, to fast, the Torah reaches to court failure. When you attempt to grasp a great deal, you are grasped nothing. In crucial periods, our sages did not hesitate to make special enactments for their own or for a limited period of time in order to meet the challenges of new circumstances. That's the conservative response. And now Rav Twersky comments. This is Rav Twersky talking. Conservative rabbis who adamantly insisted that they were operating within according to principles of halacha promoted these arguments. In their ignorance, they misconstrued and misapplied the sources they cited and disordered halachic process on halacha. Today, conservative Jews, Hashem Yerachem, are disappearing. A frightening paragraph. And finally, at the end, he writes as follows. This is what I meant about apologetics, this last paragraph. Our job is to accept the Torah and explain it. And explain what the Torah's position is. The Torah is perfect. We're with Hashem. And it's not that we're trying to be on the defensive. We're happy with what the Torah says. And if the Western culture contradicts the Torah, okay, so the Torah is right. The Western culture is wrong. And that's just the way it is. He writes here, Torah Hashem Tamim HaMashivas Nafesh Yedus Hashem Nemana Mechimas Pesi. Torah of Hashem is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of Hashem is trustworthy, making the simple one wise. The orders of Hashem are upright, gladdening the heart. The command of Hashem is clear, enlightening the eyes. The fear of Hashem is pure, enduring forever. The judgments of Hashem are true, altogether righteous. Acceptance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah does not simply entail practical compliance. Acceptance also reflects firm belief and evinces a reverential attitude. We accept Torah with a sense of awe, joy, privilege, and pride because we perceive it for what it is, chokhmah, perfect, upright, gladdening, enlightening, true. Accordingly, we accept Torah with humility and submissiveness. This is what acceptance of Torah ought to be. What acceptance of Torah is, however, in today's world, in some circles, does not correspond. We are witness to a profoundly disturbing, religiously untenable phenomenon. Consciously or unconsciously, people want to hold fast onto some secular anti-Torah Western values and simultaneously Torah. They are committed to some anti-Torah values, cast Torah to a degree in an adversarial role, and thus consciously or unconsciously, in a futile attempt to reconcile the irreconcilable, they push, twist, and manipulate halacha to make it more congenial to their opposing Western values. Somehow or other, the Torah has to be made malleable enough to accommodate their dual loyalties. This is what's happening nowadays, and again, we have a march of centuries going on here, and we have to follow the guidance. Once Rav Schechter always quotes from Rav Soloveitchik. The Rav put in one of the footnotes in one of his Sfarim that he published, there's Chiddush and there's Shinui. Once in a while new things pop up, but Chiddush is okay sometimes and Shinui's not. Who decides what's a kosher Chiddush or a non-kosher Shinui? So the answer is, it's always been the Gedolim have decided. And once in a while they argue, but the Gedolim decide. And what happens when you don't follow the guidance of the Gedolim, so you have what Rav Twersky says about the conservative movement, conservative Jews, Hashem Yerachem, are disappearing. So we have to be aware, we have this beautiful Mesorah that we have, and we're proud of it, and we're learning Torah, we're learning the Rashba, we hope the Rashba smiles in our shir as well. That's my favorite line. Every book I ever read, everything I ever heard, that line, go through life, is what I'm doing now, that the Rashba smiles gently while you're sitting there in shir or trying to live your life as an Obed Hashem at home. We have a beautiful Masorah. It's perfect. Sometimes, okay, if you have a question, it's good to ask a question. Try to understand what the Masorah is. But it's not our job to change things or adjust things. The Torah is perfect just the way it is. Torah Hashem at Tamima. And these are big issues, and you should follow the guidance of the big people. So like I said, that's how the system works. Rav Shechter writes tshuvas. Rav Twersky writes the heavy three. He's written so far three. I sent them out in the list. Three heavy articles, and the month-to-month, week-to-week discussion of it, to see what's happening out there where those are applied, is the person doing it mostly now. His name is Rav Gordimer. It's worthwhile to see. Okay. There's a story, and then we'll close with the story. Rav Shlomo Karbach tape, Olav Shalom, I think so. A tape that I heard of, and I think it's one of his books, too. So one week, the Stolen Chassidim, the Rebbe says we're going to daven in some other town, far away. I said, okay, Rebbe. So they get in their wagons, 40 Chassidim, they're going into town, they're going one town, the next town, the next, it's getting late. And they finally get to a town, and we say, we'll daven here. Now, he says a story that it's Mincha. They daven Mincha at midnight. Now, I have a hard time with that, so I'm going to pretend they said Maariv. So let's make it Maariv. But really, the original says Mincha, it says Mincha, but I can't. So I'm telling you, I'm switching it to Maariv. So let's make it Maariv, but it says Mincha. All right. Anyway, what can I tell you? So the davening Maariv, they come to town, they're davening Maariv. Now they yell, so they need a place to daven. So they went to the local inn, and the guy, the innkeeper comes out, and he's a very old man. And he says, yeah, you can daven here, you can pray in the garden of my inn. So they're davening there. Now they yell when they daven. You never go to the Stolen Karlin, they yell when they daven. They're yelling at midnight, wakes everyone up, and then the goyim come down, and they're also praying to God, and it's everyone's davening. It's the greatest Kiddush Hashem, and they're davening. And they give fruits to the Rebbe, a present to the Rebbe. Okay. And then it's time to leave. So as they're leaving, the Rebbe turns to the old man and he says, Nu, what do you have to tell me? So the old man says, the innkeeper, today is my 107th birthday. On my 7th birthday, the Baal Shem Tov came here with his students to pray. And they prayed and they yelled and everyone came down and everyone gave them. And as they were leaving, the Baal Shem Tov put his hands on my head. And he gave me a blessing. And he said, you're going to live a long life. You're going to live a long life. And when my Talmidim come here, tell them I was here before them. And 100 years later, the Baal Shem Tov's Talmud comes there with his Talmidim as well. That's the march of centuries. We have a beautiful, beautiful Masorah. If we live our lives as Jews the way our great-great-grandparents did, we're going to be very okay. The Rashba is going to be smiling if we live our lives that way. And we should be very, very careful. Very careful. Chiddush once in a while happens. The Beis Yaakov movement was a chiddush, a massive chiddush. And she got the haskama from different gedolim, so the Beis Yaakov movement worked. We have to be so careful from shinui, because we see what happens. And unfortunately, these things are happening nowadays. So Bezrat Hashem, we all should absorb the message of the march of a century. I hope the Rashba, but for us, at least in this article, that the Rashba should smile gently in how we live our lives. Okay, we'll stop here.
Before closing, I wanted to add more selections from Rav Twersky's articles. They're available on Torah Web, and they're very, very important. Rav Twersky writes, quoting from Rav Soloveitchik, Tversky writes in explaining Rav Soloveitchik's approach. The Torah values men and women equally. The Torah is emphatic. Men and women alike are created in Hashem's image, which is the source of their majesty and places them at the pinnacle of creation. Therefore, taught Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal, men and women are endowed with equal ontological spiritual worth. The supportive dimension within the feminine role is not at odds with the axiom of ontological equality, or when necessary, unofficial initiative and leadership. Unfortunately, societal attention is disproportionately focused and its accolades showered upon public high-profile personalities. In truth, only a cooperative venture between public and private individuals is significant and enduring. Accordingly, the Torah cherishes and rewards the private supporting roles equally. We are plagued by a fundamental misconception. Contrary to the popular held belief, the role of mother and wife does not subordinate a woman's personal religious fulfillment to that of her husband and her sons. Ultimate religious fulfillment and perfection is paradoxically simply defined, refining one's character and channeling all of one's thoughts and actions, energies and abilities to implementing Hashem's will. Service of Hashem by men and women entails subordinating one's will to Hashem's will and conforming to divine guidelines. Otherwise, one's service deteriorates into self-worship and self-gratification. In sum, the axiomatic equality of men and women must be properly understood. Unlike its mathematical counterpart, ontological equality is not expressed in sameness or identity. While the Torah assuredly does not discriminate against men or women, undoubtedly it does discriminate between them. That's a crucial sentence. The Torah does not discriminate against men or women, but it does discriminate between them. The two genders profoundly differ physically, emotionally, and psychologically. Though contemporary Western society and thought decry this politically incorrect notion, it remains an unalterable fact of Hashem's creation. Little wonder, then, if the Torah has delineated somewhat different tasks to the profoundly different genders. And here, Rav Tversky contrasts the Torah's approach, as he just explained it, to the fundamental yesodos of feminism. Feminism, by contrast, axiomatically asserts that men and women must be offered identical roles and opportunities, while understanding and empathizing with the struggles of modern women. We must unabashedly and unequivocally teach that this feminist demand within the religious sphere is irreconcilable with Torah norms and values. The vast, unbridgeable chasm that divides divine Torah norms and values from, lehavdil, their secular feminist counterparts, has generated and continues to fuel the present crisis. Rampant, misleading rhetoric has confused the contemporary debate in orthodoxy and feminism and camouflages the core issue. All disclaimers and declarations of halachic fealty notwithstanding, the premise and many positions of feminism are essentially incompatible with our Mesorah. A fundamental fateful decision confronts us. Do we seek to manipulate and inevitably ultimately violate halacha to accommodate our secular orientation, or do we strive to acclimate and reorient ourselves to halacha? Case in point, do we presumptuously challenge the provision which disqualifies women from positions of formal religious authority and demand the ordination of women, or do we unqualifiedly submit to halacha and intensify our efforts to appreciate, internalize, and implement its norms and values? Do we allow external contemporary fashions to make spurious demands on the Torah, or do we permit the Torah's teachings concerning women to mold our thinking and energize our initiatives? In truth, there is no choice. We must forgo the popular appeal and instantaneous gratification of the path of religious accommodationism and opt for the more arduous yet divinely authentic path of Torah. Recent feminist pronouncements vividly demonstrate the inherent dangers and ultimate direction of the movement. For example, some feminists have adopted the slogan, where there is rabbinic will, there is halachic way. Students of halacha immediately recognize the patent falsehood of this claim. Students of history easily discern a classical manifestation of reformist ideology and tactics. I've been reading from Rav Twersky's article presenting the Rav's approach to women's tefillah groups. And in it, he also relates to giving smicha to women, and that's why how it connects to the shir about the March of Centuries. Elsewhere, Rav Twersky talks about how making accommodations to feminism leads to assimilation. First, as I mentioned earlier, he refers to the conservative approach to halacha, and he says, conservative rabbis who adamantly insisted that they were operating within and according to principles of halacha promoted these arguments. In their ignorance, they misconstrued and misapplied the sources they cited and disordered halachic process and halacha. Today, conservative Jews, Hashem Yerachem, are disappearing. Oh. As already explained, the real underlying issue is the Torah's religious gender differentiation. Accordingly, any accommodation, nolens volens, I think that means automatically, accepts and reinforces the inimical premise that avenues and expressions of Avodas Hashem for men and women must be identical. Such acceptance is wholly unacceptable. First of all, it distorts Torah. Moreover, such acceptance and accommodation actually alienate women from Torah. And here Rav Twersky makes a very strong argument, which unfortunately is happening right in front of our eyes. The process of alienation is tragically straightforward and frighteningly quick. As just noted, accommodation validates and reinforces the inimical egalitarian impulse, but cannot satisfy it. Brushing aside the Ramah's ruling does not make halacha conform to the egalitarian creed. Seen from the twisted perspective of egalitarianism, women still suffer from discrimination. They are excluded from serving as shliach tzibur. Halachas of marriage and divorce are most decidedly unegalitarian. By reinforcing the egalitarian impulse without satisfying it, every accommodation intensifies the demand for further accommodations. But that demand can never be met with because Torah and egalitarianism are fundamentally incompatible. And thus, accommodationism, Rechmano Litzlan, inevitably results in alienation and assimilation. And here's the paragraph that connects to women rabbis. Tragically, this process of assimilation has already partially materialized. Yesterday's women's tefillah groups, which stem from the same egalitarian impulse, no longer suffice. Today, tefillin, partnership minyanim, and women rabbis are sought, and the handwriting is on the wall. And the handwriting on the wall is unmistakable. Tomorrow, these stopgap anti-halach concessions will no longer suffice. The current path leads inexorably to a black hole of complete assimilation, Rachmano Litzlan. Very important ideas. The idea that men and women have to be treated exactly the same. In every way, the Western view of egalitarianism is incompatible with Torah. And that leads, as Rav Twersky explains very strongly, to assimilation. And finally, Rav Tversky, in his article on women's role in Judaism, the role of the Jewish woman, where he directly deals with women rabbis again, discusses assimilation, not just practical assimilation, but what he calls ideational assimilation. Ideational assimilation occurs when we absorb ideas and values antithetical to Torah from the surrounding culture. Often these ideas and values imperceptibly penetrate our minds and hearts by osmosis. Having penetrated our minds, they dictate them our mindset. Sometimes the infection of assimilation reaches so deep within our being that we mistake transient Western societal values for absolute universal values. And then we proceed to zealously, self-righteously reinterpret, in reality, obviously misinterpret, Torah accordingly. To be specific, Western society is aggressively egalitarian. It equates equality with uniformity and diversity with inequality. Let's say that again. The Western society equates equality with uniformity and diversity with inequality. This Western social axiom stands in marked contrast to the traditional Jewish view. In the words of the Rav, the Halacha has discriminated between axiological equality pertaining to the divine essence and metaphysical uniformity at the level of the existential personal experience. Men and women are different persona, endowed with singular qualities and assigned different distinct missions in life. Hence, axiological equality should not level up the uniqueness of these two sexual personalities. And then, Rav Tversky again emphasizes that we have no need to be apologetic in explaining the Torah's approach in contrast to the Western world. Let us step back for a moment and reflect. Obviously, there is never any reason whatsoever to feel apologetic, insecure, or inferior in openly rejecting transient societal mores and axioms in favor of Ratzon Hashem. But a moment's reflection will, Bezer Hashem, strengthen our Yetzer HaTov in combating the Yetzer Hara. Without minimizing the accomplishments or virtues of modern society, an objective assessment is simply staggering. In the realm of intimacy, where above all Kedusha is to be sought and realized, popular Western culture rejects chastity and sanctity in favor of vulgarity and promiscuity. In general, Western culture rejects sneas in favor of ostentatiousness. It rejects self-effacement in favor of self-aggrandizement. It rejects busha in favor of shamelessness. It rejects more religious discipline, the bedrock of halacha, in favor of self-gratification. It rejects inwardness and authenticity in favor of extroversion and empowerment. Obviously, such a society cannot appreciate the sanctified lifestyle of tznius. Obviously, such a society cannot understand or appreciate the feminine tselem Elohim. But B'nai Yisrael are Baishanim, and we have the Torah Kedosha. We can appreciate authentic Torah values. Why do we allow ourselves to be brainwashed and assimilate? And why, even when we appropriately reject ordination of women, do we do ourselves the disservice of constantly talking about increasing leadership roles for women as though that were an ideal? Such talk only reinforces ideational assimilationist tendencies. Instead of such short-sighted accommodationism, we should be accurately, effectively, and proudly projecting the Torah's beautiful vision of tznius in Avodas Hashem. These are just some of the ideas Rav Tversky mentions. I would strongly encourage you to download his 3 articles from Torah Web on women's issues. Actually, now it's 4 articles. And go through them very carefully. Presents the Torah 2 approach, and particularly the Rav's approach on these in Yanim.